10, 11 and 12 are in some sense a unity. Chapter 10 is the introduction to the last vision or revelation that Daniel receives from God in the second section of the book. You may remember that we have found the first six chapters of Daniel, which are the first half of the book, are concerned so often with Daniel's interpretation of other people's dreams. And from chapter 7 to the end, what we find is Daniel's experience of dreams and visions and revelations himself. And these revelations from God are chiefly about history, not just about future history, but about all history. Like the book of Revelation, which is closely connected with the book of Daniel, as you will know, these chapters are designed as an eye-opener, which is what Revelation or Apocalypse means. And God is really saying to Daniel, come, he says, in the midst of all the agonies of living out the life of a man of God in a pagan world, in the midst of all the to-and-froing of history and the anguish of the great powers and great nations as they appear to be so lost in their violence. Come and I will show you behind the scenes who really rules history. Whose hand is ultimately in control of history? What the ultimate outcome of all history will be. And that is what Daniel sees in his visions. And here he is moving to the climax of this vision. And the last chapters of Daniel lead us into the last vision of the history of the world. Both Daniel in the Old Testament and John, the author of Revelation in the New Testament, as you know, are in exile. Daniel in Babylon, where he is learning to sing the Lord's song in a strange land. And John in Patmos, where he is led to a new understanding of the tribulation of God's people. And in both situations, they are discovering from God where the real battles in human history are fought, who the real antagonists are, and what the outcome ultimately will most certainly be. We need that kind of vision in our generation just as much as Daniel in his and John in the early days of the Christian church. We need that same vision of the ultimate victory and final dominion that belonged to the Ancient of Days and to the Son of Man. And Daniel is unfolding to us how that vision came to him in his day. But chapter 10, to which we turn this morning, is really an introduction to that final vision. The vision itself is unfolded in chapters 11 and 12. It's really a revelation of a word that God has given or spoken to Daniel. But the chapter that we read this morning is by itself an immensely important chapter and sets the scene for this final revelation and has some vital lessons for us to learn. I want us to concentrate on the brief time we have on three of these lessons today. The first thing that strikes you at the very beginning of this chapter is the remarkable burden of a man of God. And that's the first thing that I want to focus our attention upon this morning. Do you notice in verses 2 and 3 how Daniel describes it? In those days I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself the evidence of joy, you know, the anointing oil. He says, I did not anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. Now in verse 1 of the chapter, Daniel is obviously aware that what God is going to have to say to him is in many ways going to be profoundly disturbing, as God's voice frequently is. But as he speaks about history and about the future, Daniel is aware that the message that is coming to him is a disturbing message. The NIV specifically says the message concerns a great war, you will notice. But the original could equally refer to a great sense of conflict and turmoil in Daniel's own soul about the nature of the revelation, and the two, of course, are in no sense mutually exclusive. Daniel comes to us, however, at the beginning of chapter 10, a man who, in an intense and unusual sense, perhaps strange to us, and that may itself be significant, burdened and troubled to the point where he is fasting and humbling himself before God and mourning for 3 weeks continuously. Now many people have asked, what is Daniel mourning about? What has caused him to fast and withdraw from the normal comforts of daily life, and particularly to be under this sense of a great cloud of sorrow and burden and distress of soul? Because that he certainly was. Later on in the chapter, as the revelation begins to come nearer, he finds his very body affected by it. And he is weakened and broken in body, cast down on all fours, as it seems, before God. Now, what is it that is troubling the man? That's the question. What is this remarkable burden that this man of God, who occupies such a crucial place in the purpose of God for his exiled people and for their future in God's plan, what is it that's troubling him? Well, the answer clearly is, and you can see it from the history of the times, it is the condition of God's people that's troubling him, the state of God's cause, the honor of God's name. These are the things that rack this man's soul, so that he turns aside from food and finds himself bound in distress of soul before God. The condition of God's people, of course, you will know, is that some of them had gone back to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel, a small portion of the people. Some think that Daniel is distressed because so many of God's people had lost heart for God's land. They had lost heart to meet with God, to build his temple, to put the things of God first in their lives. And Daniel mourns because such a great proportion of God's people were content with Babylon. And what had certainly happened to the people of God is not only that they were in exile in Babylon, but that Babylon had got into them. My friends, do you ever get troubled about that in God's church? Amongst God's people, how readily we settle down in Babylon and God's song is not on our lips. And we care little. The state of God's cause burdened him, because it seemed that those people who had gone back into Jerusalem had made little headway in building the temple of God, the foundations of it by this date. You'll notice the date in chapter 10, verse 1. The foundations of the temple had been laid, but they had made little headway with building it. And the glory of God, the temple of God, seemed to be little further forward. And the Samaritans that hindered them in the building, you can read the story in the book of Ezra. And Daniel is bowed down before God because of this. And the honor of God's name, which was the chief thing at Daniel's heart, burdened him. Now for that reason, he says, in these days I, Daniel, was mourning. For 3 weeks I fasted, turned aside from all the normal delicacies and delights of life. And my dear friends, we are bound to pause and ask ourselves, are these the things that affect us most deeply? What are the things that really touch your soul at the deepest level? What are the things that cause you to know some kind of disturbance and distress of spirit like Daniel? Have you ever really found your soul racked like Daniel because of the state of God's people? Because of the cause of God's gospel? And because of the honor of God's name? I have often said that there are tears of grace as well as tears of nature. We all weep tears of nature. The tears that affect us in separation and sorrow. The tears that affect us in loss and personal pain and distress. But there are tears of grace, beloved. And only Christians weep them. Jeremiah wept them. Do you remember? In chapter 13, verse 17, he cries, "If you will not listen to God's people, if you will not listen, my soul will weep in secret for your pride. My eyes will weep bitterly and run down with tears because the Lord's flock has been taken captive." It's not for nothing that Jeremiah was called the weeping prophet. It was not that he was a melancholic individual. It was not that he was struck with morbidity. I tell you why it was. It was because he cared for the honor of God. He cared for the glory of God amongst his people. He cared for the progress and prosperity of the work of God. And his soul wept within him. These are the tears of grace. Paul wept them. "I have great heaviness," he says in Romans 9:2, "I have great heaviness and unceasing anguish of heart for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh." I will never forget standing in a hall in Glasgow years ago when Cambodia had not yet fallen to the Khmer Rouge, and listening to one of the godliest men I've ever had the privilege of meeting, Chiak Dang, who was a major in the Cambodian army. And he stood in public, not an excessively emotional man at all, really, but he stood in public and appeal to people to pray for Cambodia. And his soul was racked, as at one point all he could say was, "My people, oh my people, there without God and without hope, pray for my people." My dear friends, that's what the service of God is all about. That is what it means to be called to share the burden with God. And that's the cost of it. Don't slip over these words too easily, will you? I was mourning for 3 weeks. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks, because I tell you, what began to happen in heavenly places in succeeding weeks could be traced right back by a straight line to the burdens that were on that man's soul as he wept before God. Now that leads me to the next thing. The remarkable burden of a man of God. Will you notice with me the effective prayer of a servant of God? For it's not really surprising that it was to such a man that God drew near, is it? That's what we were reading about this morning. You did grasp that in our reading, did you? That what is happening to this man is that in a peculiar sense, God is drawing near to him. Just look at verse 4, for example. On the 24th day of the first month, I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris. I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of the words of his words like the noise of a multitude. Now it's often asked, who was this figure? Was this an angel who had come from God? Well, it might have been. Or could it have been that this is the appearance of the Lord of glory himself? Because if you take time this afternoon to read Ezekiel chapter 1 and Revelation chapter 1, you will discover an extraordinary similarity between this description of the angel figure who came upon Daniel and the glory of God in Ezekiel 1 and the presence of the Son of Man in heaven in Revelation 1. The descriptions almost match each other. And some have therefore said this is clearly the Son of God breaking through into the presence of his servant. And I think however we interpret it, that's the vital thing. The vital thing is here that this man who was burdened before God and entered into the kind of things that tore the heart of God as well as the heart of Daniel, suddenly the living God broke through from heaven and the glory of God dawned on the man's soul. Now, that's what real prayer is all about. You notice in verse 7 the others didn't see anything. He wasn't the only man there. But in verse 7, I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me didn't see the vision, but a great trembling fell upon them, a bit like Paul on the Damascus Road. But what happened to him is that here Daniel is suddenly brought into the presence of the glory of God, and has opened momentarily. And in his infinite glory has come down to reveal himself to this man. And I tell you, my friends, the reason that this is so strange to us is that so few of us really know what it is to wait on God like this. It's an extraordinary thing that we are strangers to this experience. Now look at three things about Daniel's praying. There's just time to mention. You will notice the very first thing that this heavenly figure tells him is that God hears prayer and answers it. Verse 12, then he said to me, that is when this figure came to him, and he raised Daniel up and said, Daniel, man greatly beloved. Oh, you don't need me to tell you what made him a man greatly beloved by God, do you? Give heed to the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your mind to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of them. Now Daniel was kept waiting, as you will know, without evidence for many days that God had heard. He had no idea what was happening, you know. There he was, crying to God, his soul burdened, everything else put out of the way because he wanted to concentrate on waiting on God, but he had no evidence that God had heard him. And the angel of God comes to him and says, from the first day you set yourself to pray like that, God heard you. And that's what Daniel says to us this morning at this point. God hears prayer. Now you dare not be misled by the devil's lie against that there is no answer, there is no one there, there is no point in it. Heaven cries to Daniel. God hears prayer, and heaven does that because they want Daniel to keep at it. And us as well. So God hears prayer. You notice the second thing here. Satan resists true prayer. Notice the strange thing that the heavenly figure says to him. Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your mind to understand and humble yourself before God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. But, verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. That's the 3 weeks. But Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, so I left him there with the prince of the kingdom of Persia and came to make you understand what is to befall your people in the latter days. Who is the prince of Persia who withstood this divine messenger who came from the presence of God? And he says, I was held back by the prince of Persia. Who is? Well, now he is not a human figure, because the leader and monarch of Persia is always called the king of Persia, never the prince. But it's very clear from this and from what Daniel is going to hear from the angelic figure soon that he is a spiritual prince, one of the spiritual rulers and principalities and powers of whom Paul speaks in Ephesians 6. Let me read to you some words of a great Lutheran commentator called Leupold. Bad angels, he said, called demons in the New Testament are without a doubt referred to here. In the course of time, these demonic powers gained a very strong influence over certain nations and the government of these nations, hence the Prince of Persia. Behind the monarch of Persia, there is a controlling power. Perhaps the monarch is unaware of it. They used whatever resources they could muster to hamper God's work and thwart his purpose. We get a rare glimpse here behind the scenes of world history. There are spiritual forces at work far in excess of what men who disregard revelation would suppose. They struggle behind the struggles that are written on the pages of history. They explain the satanic evil that comes to light under the things that appear on the surface. Now, that's an important lesson for us to learn. That here what Daniel is seeing, you see, is that the real sphere and arena in which the battles are being fought out for the souls of men and within the history of the world is in the spiritual realm. And there's a lesson here for us, of course. When we engage in the Lord's work, my dear friends, doesn't matter how we engage in it or what sphere we are in it or how we are occupied, but let me tell you this. When we engage in the Lord's work, we are not really challenging simply people's wills to bow to Christ or people's intellects that they might be convinced of the truth. We are indeed not just challenging men at all. We are challenging the unseen powers of darkness. And the angel Michael, oh, that there were time to tell you a little more about Michael. You will remember where Michael comes. He comes twice in the New Testament, in Jude 9 and in Revelation 12. Michael, the archangel, did battle with the dragon and with his angels. But here you will see the significant thing is Michael comes to the aid of this heavenly messenger in dealing with the prince of Persia. Now Michael challenged the powers of darkness by his very name. His name means, who is God other than the Lord? And he, by his very name, is challenging the powers of darkness. But that's what we are doing when we are engaging in the service of God, and that's why the service of God involves us in costly warfare. If the service of God doesn't cost you anything, I say to you this morning, you're not really touching the real place where the battle is fought. And that, too, is why the real battle is fought in the place of prayer. That is the front line, my friends. And it's important to know where the front line is when you're fighting a battle, isn't it? Great pity if you go away to another place and think that's the front line and you're fighting on another front altogether. And so many Christian people do precisely that. And that's one of the reasons the cause of God is so moribund so frequently in Christian history. Satan resists true prayer. Let me just turn you to the last thing I want to talk about, the remarkable burden of a man of God, the effective prayer of a servant of God. I am here, he says. Heaven has broken through because of the prayers of this man of God. He says, I am here because you have called. But you notice in the last place for Daniel, the transforming touch of the hand of God. Do you notice how often, three times over, in fact, in our reading, Daniel experiences the touch of God upon his life? It's a remarkable thing. In verse 10, verse 16, and verse 18, on each occasion he says, a hand touched me, or I was touched by one who had the likeness of the sons of men. In verse 10, he has a touch of encouragement from God. Behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees, and he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved. Then verse 12, fear not, for from the first day that you set your mind to understand, and so on, I have come now, he says, because of your words. He knew the touch of God upon his life as a touch of encouragement. Verse 16, he tells us he knew the touch of God as a touch of utterance upon his lips. Verse 16, behold, one in the likeness of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke. And when in the midst of entering into this kind of spiritual warfare, he found the very strength drained out of him. Do you notice in verse 18, he has a touch of power. A touch of renewal from God. Again, one having the appearance of a man touched me and strengthened me and said, O man greatly beloved, fear not, peace be with you. Be strong and of a good courage. And when he spoke to me, I was strengthened. Oh, do you see this? For the man who is ready to go God's way, to bear God's burden, to enter into the warfare at the level at which Daniel entered it, the touch of God is upon his life. And my brothers and sisters, that's what we need in our time, God knows. Men and women who have the touch of God upon their lives, upon whom the hand of God rests in this special sense, enabling, equipping, strengthening. And God will do that. God will do that. Oh, how he looks in the world of our day for men and women who will so be ready to hear him when he talks about where the real priorities lie, about where the real battles are fought, about where the real issues are decided. My brothers and sisters, that we might rise up to God this morning and say, by your grace, I will be that man or woman. I will live for such things as these. And in God's mercy, we will be drawn into the triumph of the Lord God Omnipotent. with whom Daniel dealt. Oh, that he might find a people willing in the day of his power. Let us sing together as we close our worship.